I think the answers to what to do next in one's life, where to find supply, literally come from listening. That, you know, I think that the trouble we've gotten into, I think it's an extremely exciting time for us all.
Why?
Well, because I think the whole foundation of what we trusted, what we rested on, our sense of what was substance that would uphold us, that would maintain stability in our lives, is crumbling right in front of our eyes. I mean, the institutions that we trusted, personalities that we trusted, literally money that we thought was going to be stable substance, is dissolving right in front of us. And so it is forcing us to a shift of base. And that shift of base, I think, is to a more spiritual sense of substance, or another way of talking about spiritual is ideas. That ideas don't decay; they don't lose over time their value. You don't have to refrigerate them. You know, you can an idea that was articulated 100 years ago. You didn't have to keep it anywhere to keep it alive or viable. Those ideas, which might have seemed so intangible, actually turn out to be the substance that lasts and we can depend on.
Can you think of an idea in your own life that's been enduring? Like you said, that you don't have to refrigerate, that it maintains its value or maybe increases in value?
Well, yes. I'm thinking to myself of what we're seeing as undermining our sense of stability. And it is really a crime, that this lack of trustworthiness. You think of trust as being, you know, like sort of, well, we can't see it. The senses don't take it in. But everything rests on it. And now that there has been a shaking of that trust, the whole world is shaken. I had a dear friend who spent his life in the legal profession. He was a lawyer, a prosecutor, and then a federal judge. And he said to me once, I can tell you the whole heart of crime in one word: selfishness. And I have thought and thought about that, you know, because what's underneath selfishness? Fear. And what is the reverse of fear and selfishness? Love.
Mm.
And, you know, you think about the Golden Rule or the Ten Commandments. I mean, basically they are, as Jesus put it, to love another as oneself. So that is really the opposite of selfishness. But it doesn't exclude the self. It embraces the self with love as well as the other. And that is the antidote to crime. And if you're with someone who really lives to the heart that law, that golden rule, you trust them. I mean, we're in the middle of a correction. Mm-hmm. It's wonderful. I was thinking to myself about something in Proverbs where it says, my son, despise not the chastening of the Lord, neither be weary of correction. For whom the Lord loveth, he correcteth. And that's what we're experiencing, a correction. Happy is the man who findeth wisdom and getteth understanding, for the merchandise of it is better than the merchandise of silver, and the gain thereof than fine gold. So we're seeing here, you know, a correction that perhaps will replace a shaky, more materialistic sense of substance with something more enduring, which is a more spiritual sense of substance.
So you've been engaged in this practice of creative listening, listening without fear, for many years. And I'm wondering, you know, given what you're describing about this current economic moment, both how you're bringing that practice to bear on your own life at this time, and what you may or may not be doing differently now.
I am trying more and more deeply to live this. Because, and I think one of the things that we really love about dance as a medium, you might think, like, wow, who wants to dance? Not very many people feel very secure doing something like that, except maybe dancer types. But actually, what's so wonderful about movement is that it manifests your thinking, that it isn't just theoretical. You know, there's that phrase, shut up and dance. I mean, you just have to show the goods. You have to live what you want to convey. You have to embody what you want to convey.
Mm-hmm.
And so movement is a wonderful way of really showing or revealing what is being thought. And so if you're listening, if you're improvising a dance and you're listening, people can see that. When you stop listening and start to think, start getting scared and then sort of manipulating the dance, willing it, pushing it around, that's immediately apparent to the onlooker. And the ideas really sort of don't work. Because you're dancing with other people, you know, you can't really force them to do something. You could, but it doesn't really work in making a dance. And so I think that the that medium of movement is a very, it makes you an honest, pretty honest, and it's also dependable. Once you do it through movement, it's like you've had a dry run, and you kind of know what the thought processes feel like when you apply the same principles of paying attention without fear to anything else you have to do, whether it's writing a letter or deciding on what you're going to do for the rest of your life, you know, what you're on a career move, or whether or not to have kids,
mm-hmm.
or, you know, any from the smallest to the deepest questions, you begin to have a trust in, you've practiced, in a sense, the thought processes, and can more easily take those into real life situations where the fear might be much deeper than they would be just making a dance.
Now, you had described this work earlier to me, for you, as being spiritual. And I wanted to understand that better, how it's also a kind of spiritual practice for you.
Well, you know, in harking back to things that we've said a little earlier, matter is finite, and that's one of the reasons, that's the basic reason it fails us, is it keeps changing form. We think, that's the solid thing, whereas spirit and things spiritual, like ideas, they tend to be lasting, and they are really an infinite source of supply. So I think it was my deep desire for stability from the time I was a very small child that sent me on seeking after spiritual things, seeking after understanding. I also see it as this issue of listening, which is the basic practice, paying attention, I think of as the heart of prayer. I don't think the heart of prayer really is, you know, sending the divine a wish list. It is asking that a higher sense of wisdom, where shall I go? What shall I do? And when you improvise, you don't direct the dance. You receive the dance, sort of like a radio receives the waves. The radio doesn't create the program. I think of it like Elisha, who was a Hebrew prophet, and he's running away from people who are pursuing him to kill him, and he's in despair, and he goes to a mountain, and he encounters earthquakes, winds, and fire. And it says in the Bible, well, God was not in the earthquake, God was not in the wind, God was not in the fire, and then came the still small voice. And that still small voice to me is the answer to prayer. And when we get our own agenda out of the way enough, we get down on our knees enough, we trust enough to say, I'm listening. What do you have to say? Then we get answers that are quite extraordinary. And the wonderful thing I love about it all is that it doesn't have to be, there are no doctrinal divisions with this discipline of listening. You don't have to be a Jew or a Muslim or a Christian or a Buddhist or, you know, everybody. Or you don't even have to have any religious belief at all. This works. This discipline of paying attention without fear, of getting your willfulness, which is a form of fear, out of the way enough so that you can listen, and being willing to follow, it works as well for anyone, regardless of how he or she explains it.
So if somebody is listening to this and they are inspired to want to practice this in their own lives and they haven't been, you know, to a workshop or to one of your classes, what is something that a person can do on a very practical level to try this out in their own lives?
Well, let's just take an example. Say you're going to sit down, just a simple one, and write a letter. And, you know, you're thinking, like, how am I going to formulate this letter? What am I going to say? Instead of getting out there and writing and then rewriting, crossing out, you know, editing, la, la, la. Start first by setting that aside, that is, our preconceptions of what we should say, and all the human effort that gets in the way of listening. When we think, oh, it's the responsibility is on our shoulders, we have to manufacture this, we have to somehow produce this, we have to be smart enough to get this right. Set that aside and simply listen. And one might focus on, you know, what matters most to say. I mean, what is the basic thing that one wants to communicate? And then just like a scribe, write down what comes. And one of the things we discovered is that an idea comes with its own supply. It comes with its own expression. If you will listen to the idea, it will come with its own perfect expression. And in this case, the expression would be words, but it could be anything. If you're dancing, it could be movement. If you're trying to work out a financial problem, it could be an idea for how to go forward. So that's the way you begin. You make space. I would call that sacred space. You know, you make space to listen. There's a very interesting thing about performing, about art, because art is all about paying attention. Whether you are creating art or performing art or observing art, in each one of those cases, it is all about paying attention. And when we put a frame around a picture, that frame says, we put this on the wall, pay attention to what goes on in this space. And we set aside our busyness and our distraction of mind and our fussing around a static, mental static, and focus as an audience. Or if we're a performer, focus on in that space in the way that we don't usually. And that focus creates almost what I would call sacred space. And in that space, we can hear the still small voice. And if fear tries to come in, you're sitting down to do a task or you're facing something like, gee, where is my next, I need money, I need supply somehow, you know, where is that going to happen? To have almost the humility, you know, to lay aside your fear for a moment and give your thought some sacred space here to listen. this is why this is not so easy to do sometimes, particularly if the fear is great. And this is why so often when we come to a major crisis where we have no idea what to do next, that's when we are actually willing to lay down that busy human mind.
Why?
And pay attention, because we have no other way to go. And that's why hitting the wall is such a sacred space, because then we're willing. And, you know, sort of like the children of Israel coming up against the Red Sea and with the Egyptians behind them and the Red Sea in front of them. And what to do? And Moses asks God, and God says, go forward. And, I mean, I've had times in my life where that literally happened. Not the Red Sea, naturally, but you know, a situation where I was just caught between a rock and a hard place and just dropped to my mental knees and said, what to do? And the ideas come. And the ideas came. And step by step, I found my way to extraordinary answers.